The world has gone insane. Cosplayers rule the conventions. Gamers dominate the tabletop and the internet. Sci-fi subjugates the movies, and fantasy rules the bookstore with an iron fist. Only one group can bring order to this unruly mob. A team of uber geeks, masters of the nerdly arts, trained for decades in the hobby shops and basements of the nation. Mobilized by the secret masters, they are the Department of Nerdly Affairs.
Hello, operatives, and welcome to the Department of Nerdly Affairs. I'm your host, Rob Patterson, here with my co-host, Don Chisholm.
I don't have a shtick, but this time it's okay because this kind of came up last minute.
And, shh, Don, you're not supposed to tell them that.
And hey, that could be my new shtick. I can tell people behind-the-scenes stuff they're not supposed to know. Like, who doesn't wear pants when they record?
We all know it's you, Don. That's not something that's unknown.
Oh, well.
And that's just a trope. Speaking of which, we're talking about tropes, specifically fantasy tropes that people love. We spent a little bit of time talking about tropes like the Evil Overlord thing and how much I hate it a few podcasts ago. But, you know, I decided that we should be more positive about the whole thing. And coincidentally enough, there was recently a thread on Reddit about fantasy tropes that people love. A user on Reddit who goes by the name of Goofy McGee, did a survey on the Reddit fantasy group of tropes that people absolutely love, fantasy readers love specifically. And he came up with this little list, and so I thought that possibly we'd go through it today. And I couldn't think of anyone who loves the word tropes more than Jack Ward, so here he is.
Oh, you guys do this every time. It's getting so boring. It's almost a trope in and of itself, bringing this guy in.
It is. I know. I mean, this Jack Ward guy, we got to get someone fresh and new.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No, thanks for coming.
I really appreciate it.
And so, although I know there's one thing we should probably cover, though, is Don was talking before we went on the air about possibly the difference between a trope and a convention. And I think before we start talking about fantasy tropes, we should probably actually look at the whole idea of tropes themselves. We have in previous episodes. Don't worry, we're not going to spend half an hour on it like we did like an episode or two ago. But I think it's worth talking about what is and isn't a trope one more time. So Don, take it away.
Okay, I'm going to put this out there and Jack can correct as he sees fit, because this kind of came from one of the discussions we've had outside the show where Jack had suggested using the term convention. Mm-hmm. To refer to like given writing shticks or however you define it. And I think that a convention and a trope are two different sides of the same thing. Because I'm going to say the what I was thinking is a convention is something that you do in your story, as Jack said, because it works. And it works consecutively, so it becomes almost like a routine. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to say that the word trope refers to, at least when I use it, is sometimes those conventions, they become so well established, they take on a life of their own, and they exist as part of that kind of story or genre or medium or whatever you're doing, regardless of effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And to illustrate the difference, I'm going to use the example of the slasher flick.
Okay.
The very first thing we'd recognize as a slasher flick was probably the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. And in it, a group of like teenagers on vacation ends up lost in like the backwoods, and they get murdered by a mutant guy wearing somebody's head for a mask. Mm-hmm. The premise of doing this story, what they wanted to get across, was the idea of what made the violence shocking was the idea that it could happen to anybody. And to illustrate it, you had a group of youngsters, they're on vacation, it's a good time, their whole life is ahead of them, and then it gets chopped down by a gas-powered power tool there. Mm-hmm. A couple years later, you get the original Friday the 13th. They take that idea of the teenagers getting murdered, but they add a little something to it, and that was the idea that, quote-unquote, Jason comes back for revenge because he died at the summer camp. He drowned, because the counselors who were supposed to be watching him went off to have evil, illicit premarital sex, weren't doing their job, and he died. Mm-hmm. So you take this idea of the teens getting murdered by the mutant an extra step. You've added something to it, but there's still that framework. This continues for a few slasher flicks until you get around, I'm going to say, Friday the 13th, part 3 or 4. It's the one that starts with the two guys digging up his body and he gets hit by lightning and now he comes back as a supernatural monster. And I don't remember which one it was. They all kind of blur together for me after a bit.
I think it was part 3 because if I remember right, one of the first ones it's him, one of the first ones it's actually his mother.
Yeah, the first one is his mother. The second one is him.
Right.
And then that's the one with one of the Corys shaves his head.
Okay.
I forget. But and then what happens after that is you've got this idea that the mutant murdering teenagers, I would say up until that point, is a convention. Mm-hmm. It's an idea that works. There's a lot of subliminal and liminal, I guess, if that's a term, appeal to it, because again, it's that idea of kids getting murdered, blah blah blah. When you get to like around the third one, it becomes standard that your mutant axe murderer is going to be killing off horny teenagers. Like, that becomes a staple of the slasher flick, and that's where I'd say it turns into a trope, because it no longer needs any in-continuity explanation. It's expected by the audience to the point that if you're not doing it, they get confused and frightened because you're not following the already established rules. Mm-hmm. And then that's why I say I think the concept of a convention and a trope, they're different. That the trope is when the convention becomes rooted, mm-hmm. and it no longer, whether it works or not, if I'm writing that kind of story, I have to deal with it.
Hmm. Okay, so a trope is something that has to be there then. You need it to do that kind of story?
Yeah, and it has to be there regardless of the story around it. Another good example would be like superhero secret identities. Mm-hmm. That when Superman, essentially the first superhero we'd recognize as a superhero, mm-hmm. he's Clark Kent. Well, there are reasons in the story for him being Clark Kent. But when you get a couple generations of superhero later, mm-hmm. it gets to the point that they all have a secret identity just because superheroes have secret identities. And it becomes a kind of self-perpetuating thing that if you come outside of that genre, it looks weird. Playing to my favorite example, a couple of superheroes after Superman, you get the Phantom Lady. Mm-hmm. whose costume is excessive cleavage. Like, she's not wearing a mask or anything. She's wearing a nightgown.
Yeah.
And there's literally a story where she sneaks out, changes, comes back, beats up the bad guy, sneaks out and comes back after rescuing her fiance and her dad, and they don't recognize her. But it's because
they were too busy staring at her tits. Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be it, which is weird on so many levels. But it's that kind of thing. If you're a superhero fan, it's just a given. You don't look behind the curtain. Yes. You don't have the urge to. It's just superheroes have secret identities. That's just how it goes. And at that point, it's become a trope. That there's no, you don't need in continuity explanation for it being there. You need it for it not being there.
The only issue that I have with that definition is when we get to things like plot tropes, for example. Which really mm-hmm. are just standard plots that get used, but they're still referred to as tropes because people just throw that word around left, right, and center. But I would right. but I would argue that's different than a convention, especially when we're talking about plots. They're just like, well, we usually tend to see these standard plots for these kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. There are exceptions, of course, like the romance and the mystery stories, which basically all have the exact same plot no matter what. And that right. you could argue that that's a trope, that they're required to have that to be a mystery story or a romance story. But if we're talking about like some other kinds of stories, you can have many different plots. And some are more common than others in, say, fantasy or adventure stories or science fiction or whatever. But they're not automatically part of that genre. They're not required by that genre.
Yeah, it's. I think you're right. Like, my definition is essentially a working one, okay. So this is where I'm coming from. I think you're right, but I think, again, mm-hmm. it is that kind of thing that it can be a trope because like you said, like say the murder mystery, if there's mm-hmm. really no murder or at least pretense of a murder,
right.
you don't have a murder mystery.
Yeah. You have to have certain things there, otherwise it just doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a trope and maybe a convention, because I think they can switch, because you can do something, and this is where like the movie that breaks new ground and is new and shocking. You have a murder mystery and it's a convention that there's a murder.
Right.
And that's how you get, because you've had mystery stories.
Mm-hmm.
You add the murder. After enough of these stories about murdering people where some guy investigates and blah, 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 it becomes its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a murder mystery story.
Right.
Part of what makes it that is the trope that somebody got murdered. Until somebody does the story where it only looks like somebody got murdered, and then you've created a new convention.
Mm-hmm.
That would go on and on, and if that got like used to the point where everybody expected a murder mystery that the guy didn't really get murdered at the end,
right,
then it becomes a trope and it becomes a new thing. Until then, it's still, I wouldn't even say at that point it's a convention. I think you could, because it's the kind of thing people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an essential part.
Okay, I'm just thinking about the way you're almost defining it. Almost sounds like if it's optional and a good idea, it's a convention. If it's required, it becomes a trope.
Essentially, yes. And what I'm saying is that they're not written in stone, because another one of those would be a trope would be the idea that superheroes do not kill the villain,
mm-hmm.
except every now and then they do. And then you have a dark, gritty phase, and then superheroes do kill the villain, becomes the new trope, until everybody gets, like, sick of that and hits on the new idea of, what if they're so noble they just don't kill the villain? And then that becomes the new convention, and then eventually it becomes a new trope, and then it works its way around. Like, there's fluidity in how it ends up.
Okay. What do you think, Jack?
I like what you came up with, Don. My biggest problem is, and I think Rob and I share this at times, is how people use this word like a sledgehammer without even really thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
They just, you know, and that's the problem. Like, people sit there and they say, well, you know, and you'll see this in like the Mary Sue. We're tired of this trope in stories.
Yeah.
You know, so but you're not really analyzing why that particular convention is in place. So why do you need a particular convention that makes the slasher horror movie the way the slasher horror movie is? And what could you do to change it up and still keep it as a slasher horror movie? Because if you're not following these particular conventions that are in place, well, then it's no longer a slasher horror movie, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a dark horror movie, or it's a monster horror movie, or something like that. So the idea is that, you know, it originally, the word trope comes from Greeks, and it's, you know, it was actually from classical rhetoric, which meant originally just a turn of the phrase, but it doesn't mean any of that right now. And that's fine. Words change, words grow. But we have this tendency in our modern society to come up with words just to be cool. And trope has been one of those things that you hear a lot of people who don't know what the heck they're talking about, just using the word trope to mean something that is anything at all that's been in at least two different fictions that they've seen, or a cliche. And it's always used in kind of like a negative way for things. And it's not the only thing I've seen that. Like, what used to be called someone getting their own comeuppance is obviously something you don't hear anymore. So what is that becoming? Pwning someone. But we don't say that anymore either. Now it's dunking on someone, right? Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same thing, but we have to come up with a cooler way of saying it and become even more imprecise. Right?
Right.
So this is my problem. Whenever I hear trope, I start to groan, because I know the people aren't, not with you guys. You guys pulled it apart, so I had no problem. But so many people just don't pull it apart. It's their way of saying, oh, I'm so tired of seeing this heteronormative story going on. For example, right?
Mm.
What does that mean? What does that even mean? I mean, like what are you trying to say? You know, how would you change the story to make it a better story? As opposed to just saying, I got to change the channel. Because it could be as simple as, I'm tired of zombies. That's a trope in stories now that I don't like. They don't identify whether they're talking about plot character, theme, any of those kind of things. And that imprecision, it just drives me up the wall. And so I'm gonna fight, because just like you guys, I mean, I love story. And to love story means you should really spend some time under the hood analyzing what works and what doesn't. And if you just throw things away by saying, oh geez, here we go, X-Files theme, ply it up, we've seen this happen a long time, Monster Hunt trope done, we're done with this, don't want to see it anymore. Sorry, that's not effective. That's just you researching your inner comic book guy.
Yep, I can agree with that. Yeah, no, I'm with you. Actually, my main annoyance is the idea that trope, people don't differentiate the idea between trope and cliche anymore. Right. They use them together. And the reason that drives me in batty is because you've got whole new generations of writers coming in, and they're told, "Oh, that's such a trope." Like, "Oh, you did this trope," and they interpret that as we would say, "This is a cliche." But it's like, no, it's not. These are tropes can be good or bad or neither. They're not automatically bad. But for some reason, this whole new generation, and it's driving this new generation of writers batty. I can see it. I can see it online. I can see it in my classes. Yeah.
Can you imagine if this happened in the 1600s and people sat there to Shakespeare like, man, you're using these Greek plays, these tropes are way overdone. Shakespeare would have never written his plays because they were all written before. They were all, are you telling me that revenge stories never existed before Shakespeare?
Exactly. Like, you know,
so we got to stop kicking ourselves and stop people, because there's nothing original out there. There really isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people make the mistake. And again, maybe that's one of the reasons why I hate you. Sorry to jump in on you, but I agree with you 100%.
No. And no, thank you, Jack. I'm with you. Yep. And so that's what annoys me about the whole tropes thing. And I think we can mostly blame almost all of this, I would argue, on that site, TV Tropes.
Yes.
TV Tropes, because anytime anyone did anything now, and you see it constantly on social media, people just say, here's the TV Tropes link for that thing. And it's look, how many times this has been used, so don't use that again. But it's like, but this is like a young hero growing up. Nope, been used too many times. See, you can see it here on TV Tropes. It's been used a million times. Don't use it anymore.
And why has it been used a million times? Because it works.
Because it works.
Sometimes.
Right.
Well, not in every case, but
But I mean, why people keep coming back to the same place in the well? Because that water is darn well tasty. A lot of people, if you do a good story of something that's been well done before, again, like these things, the most popular hits in movies and in books, none of them started off, like what they had was an original take. Mm-hmm. On something that people did very, very well in times before. We've talked about all the connections. You can go back from Harry Potter into the Knights of the Round Table into Star Trek. Like, there's so many connections in Star Wars, all those things. It gets frustrating when people just go, oh, can't have an old man there as somebody there to talk to him about stuff, because that old wise elder trope is way overdone.
Well, no, Jack. You can totally have the wise old character do it, but it has to be a woman now. It can't be a man.
Oh no, there's always been the wise old woman character as well, the fairy godmother character. It's just a different take on it.
Right? You're right. So we can't do that anymore. So now does that have to be an animal? Oh wait, no, those have been done too.
That's right. Especially in Disney, right? Those companion wise animals that come along. So you have to have a non-intelligent rock that the person talks to.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Yep, I guess the only mentors can be rocks now. That's just,
and they
the
can't
way it
talk
is
back, because that's already been done as a trope.
Exactly.
So the person has to talk to a rock and assume the rock is giving him information.
Yeah.
I believe that's called schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's such a trope. Use schizophrenia.
don't bring that trope up. Anyway, so here, why don't we start going through Goofy McGee's list that he managed to come up with his little survey.
Because I want to add one little bit, because I think you guys have kind of hit on one of my big problems with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Because tropes.com doesn't, if you read it, it doesn't apply a value judgment to any of the tropes.
That's true. Mm. TV Tropes doesn't. That's true.
Yeah.
But what I think happened, because what I've noticed in like the internet age is every review of anything has to be about how terrible it is.
Yes.
And there's an emphasis on that. And I've noticed, going directly to what you guys are talking about, mm-hmm. anytime I've seen people discuss, and this is even on like podcasts and websites I like, mm-hmm. Any kind of like movie or TV show that's quote unquote high concept or fantasy or science fiction, mm-hmm. there tends to be a habit of these people getting really stupid mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. point that I think they're, it's not that they don't get it. It's that they're just dismissing these things out of hand because they're not quote unquote serious drama.
Right.
Right.
Case in point, I was listening to one, they were talking about the Street Fighter movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the commentators had made the comment that they couldn't tell the characters apart. And I'm like, well, they're fucking color-coded, so you can! That shit drives me up the wall. Like, or when people talk about, like, you know, fantasy, and they're like, oh, and they had to go see the Oogie Moogics to get the boogity-boogity-boo, and I don't understand, and it's what? It's just different names for shit. They gave weird names to the same old shit. Are you that fucking stupid?! Oh, that just, it, see, that's one of my triggers. But that drives me nuts because it goes with that idea, like you two were talking about lazy reviewing. Yeah. Because it's that idea that it's not hard. It's like people I know who are like, oh, I don't get like this Pokemon thing. It's too complicated. Your fucking 6-year-old does. You're saying your 6-year-old has more mental prescience than you do. No, it's an unwillingness. And I think that's where this idea of mentioning a trope and it's instantly a bad thing comes from. Because mm-hmm. every cliche is a trope, but not every trope is a cliche.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. Exactly.
Except on the internet.
I
have the
same problem with my student. She goes, I was talking about Star Wars, and she goes, oh, I hate Star Wars. I said, really? Which ones did you watch? Oh, I didn't watch any of them. Okay, well, why didn't you watch them? Well, they're so unrealistic. Like, they're fantasy. Yeah. That's the whole point. They're not meant to be real. Yeah, that's why they're stupid. It was one of those situations you just don't get it. And again, lazy intellectual, and here's the problem is that everybody thinks that they're a geek.
Yep.
Yeah.
And maybe they're not. I mean, they're geek for something, but they're not good at everything, right? I had the same problem with memes too. I'm getting tired of memes because I heard an interesting interview. They were talking about how political cartoons are dying because mm-hmm. people are dropping mm-hmm. up these memes. So mm-hmm. they'll just take a picture of something and they'll throw some half-baked, you know, snappy comeback to stupid questions up there, and then boom, they've got themselves a meme. Obviously, they're brilliant. Throw that in, right? Yeah. So, and it's dumb because those political cartoons mm-hmm. are drawn by people with an image in mind and a thought, and it comes from an artist's perspective. Like, if you follow up somebody's political cartoons, you can find the theme of what they're trying to get in their larger work, right? But anybody can throw up a meme. All you have to do is get some sort of popular culture or picture of some sort, mm-hmm. and just throw in some sort of words in the bubble, and then you're the brilliant one, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
End any conversation instantly with a meme. So.
Yeah, that's true. And they're conversation enders. They're not conversation starters. That's the other problem with memes. Yeah.
There's absolutely no argument there. It's just a way to try to make fun of somebody.
Yep. Yep,
so you're just like, okay, nothing to say. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay, so. That's absolutely true. And I would argue that a large part of the reason this has happened with tropes is, going back to what you guys were just saying, is that everyone thinks that by being able to refer to things as tropes, oh, it's that trope or it's this trope, that it makes them sound smart.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's really what's going on. It's a whole bunch of people who, half of whom don't know what they're talking about, just trying to sound smart to people who are less educated than them or less, you know, aware of what this is than them.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And none of them could put together a great story using those tropes that they think they know so well mm-hmm. that would really grab somebody's attention. You know what I mean?
But again, it's easier to tear down than it is to build.
For sure, mm-hmm. for sure, yeah.
Exactly, cool. And attack. So let's do this.
Let's look at the list.
Let's look at the list, okay. There is no particular order to these things. He didn't put any put them up in a top 10. There's about 10 or so of them. So we'll go through them one at a time. And we'll talk about why each of them is a popular trope. These are the tropes that people love, okay? Not the ones people hate. We're being positive for the rest of this episode, mostly.
No, we're not.
Well, yeah, we've already had the screaming and the anger. Let's see if we can get some positivity
Our
going.
Our nerd rage is over.
Okay, all right, so let's get positive here. Heroic last stand, a person or group of people standing alone against an overwhelming force. So, Jack.
This is something you talk about from the Overlord side of thing, too. You didn't like this as well for the same reason. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem with this is that it's pretty anticlimactic if your final part of your story is not the highest point of your story, which means you do end up having to have, especially if you're doing an epic fantasy, you know, how's your epic fantasy end off with like a roll off or some sort of disco dance? Like it's people are not going to be happy. They want to see those heroic last stands, right?
Actually, people really liked Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I was just thinking that too.
It ended up with people really liked that actually. But in the
end,
I didn't care for that part.
There we go. But no, it made a
shit ton of money. Is it Bathos? It's Bathos. I've always hated Bathos. So Bathos is, and there's a really interesting video, what writers should learn from Wonder Woman. Okay. And so what Bathos is, it comes from Greek, right? And so what it does is it takes a really tense part of the story, and then it cuts the tension by adding comedy.
Oh, okay.
And by doing that, you actually destroy the tension of the story because you're telling the audience... this wasn't important in the first place, right? And usually it's at the moment where the character has like a defining understanding of the theme or the change that they have to have, and then they do something silly. So they give an example, for example, of where it's done badly, where if you're thinking of Doctor Strange, and he finally gets, you know, he gets the cloak put on him and the whole bit, and it's a really important moment, and then the cloak starts hitting him in the face. And so what it automatically does is it undercuts the seriousness of that moment. And so that's terrible. When it works well is when you're doing it in parody, right? Because you're actually parodying, you know, you're doing a comedy anyway. And you're so it works really, really well with Deadpool. He does some great elements of Bathos for those particular reasons, right? But if you're if you want to make me care about your character, don't make them slip on a banana peel in the, on their shining moment. Because it ruins the whole aspect of the story. So while I'm watching Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm sure lots of people thought it was funny, but it totally undercut the seriousness of that scene for me.
I could see that. Okay, sorry, Don, go.
I was going to say, I think there's a catch to it. Because one of the things that I've noticed, and I think this has to do with what we were talking a little earlier about, say, the rampant... like reviewing of everything is people forget that you can take events in any kind of story, like they run both ways. That a lot of people will use something as an example of why it's bad, but then if you think about it, they're taking it the wrong way. And this can happen here because if you've set up that you've got a character who is pretty, I don't want to say laid back, but isn't fazed by stuff, that sort of thing can be used to demonstrate character. An example would be if you did a movie like, say, they're doing a Joker movie and the Joker had his own comic back in the day, and let's say you're doing a Joker story from the Joker's point of view and he's the protagonist and he finally tracks down the guy that he's after, the nominal villain of the piece, and the Joker takes out a giant gun and points at him and goes, "Well, Bob, this is the end," and he pulls the trigger and a bang flag comes out and he laughs. That diffuses the instance, but it helps you get more into the Joker's head because it shows that, especially if you have this big, huge, gruesome, violent buildup to it.
That you have to have that buildup beforehand, though, that doesn't mean anything, right? So, well, or you have to have the gruesome thing afterwards. So the flag comes out, says bang, and then he pulls a second trigger and the flag goes through his eye. You know what I mean? So because then you're not, but it's when it actually, that moment, and that's why I said, it's the main moment in a movie where everything gels, and then they try to hit it with comedy. And he argues that they do that way too often in Marvel movies.
Oh, now they do, yeah. Guardians and, actually, I blame Guardians on that, actually.
Yeah, yeah, and they said specifically, like, Joss Whedon had a really good idea of when this worked and when it didn't. Mm-hmm. And since he's not writing for them anymore, everybody's trying to do it, and it's not working properly.
Actually, the one way. Who's horrible for it, watch the last Thor movie. The last Thor movie is, there's some brilliant moments in Thor Ragnarok. But yes. Oh my God, do they use bathos, as you put it, right. way too much. Like, the movie is constantly undercutting itself. Constantly. Yes. Every time it starts to get serious, every time there starts to be some real drama and real tension, bang, they undercut it and completely kill it.
Well, it's a comedy movie. Let's be honest. Considered to be a comedy movie. It's not considered to be a serious Thor movie. That's because the serious Thor movie, was it Dark World or whatever? I never saw it.
Yeah, Thor the Dark World. They did it super serious and everyone hated it.
Super serious and everybody hated it, right? So they want you to make fun of these comic book characters. They want you to think it's silly so that they can bring in a larger audience and say, hey, it's just a fun comedy movie, right? Yeah. But like you said, it really undercuts anything heroic.
The problem is the movie did actually have some actual good drama and things going on in it. It actually had, unlike Dark World, which wasn't very well written, and the first one, which wasn't very well written either, it's actually a well-written movie overall. Ragnarok is, but they just constantly, it drove me nuts how they were constantly undercutting it. Right. Undercutting all the drama every chance they got. But that's Taika Waititi. He's literally like this comic jester guy that they've got doing it. So that's what he does. That's his stuff. That's his style.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Although I'm not sure if he does that. There's a movie called Hunt for the Wilder People that's more of a drama. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard good things about it. But he did another one called What We Do in Shadows.
Oh, yeah.
That's Taika Waititi. That was his like big
film. That sounds familiar. I don't know.
There's a movie and a TV series. It's basically about a bunch of like gothic vampire guys hang out basically, but they're all losers and they all
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's not exactly what We Do in the Shadows. I've seen the movie. I haven't seen the show. The movie is great. It's a group of vampires that lets a film crew follow them around and do a documentary.
Okay.
And it's not exactly, they're not really losers, but it shows you all of the really mundane stuff in the lives of these vampires. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the running gags is they have a chore wheel, but they're immortal, so it hasn't moved in like 30 years. And the one guy's pissed off because the one guy's been on dishes forever and he hates doing the dishes.
I could see that happening.
Yeah. So he doesn't want to do dishes. It piles up. And it's a good example of doing that kind of thing, but it works because... Mm. You've set this up where you're getting all of your usual vampire tropes and conventions, but you're seeing them from a different angle. You're seeing a more, I won't say realistic, but the mundane parts of what that would really be like. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, but it's funny because you're like, yeah, that's exactly what would happen.
Right.
Okay. No, I can see that. I just wanted to go back to this trope, heroic last stand, people standing alone against the overwhelming force. That's not automatically the evil overlord thing. And I'm totally okay with people having a last stand against the overwhelming force. Seven Samurai, there's no evil overlord there. Overwhelming force. And no, it's there are many kinds of overwhelming forces. And I've got no problem with that.
There's an evil overlord, the main leader of the bandit thieves or whatever.
I wouldn't qualify him as an evil overlord. I would just qualify him as he's a bandit leader. There's a difference between to me, an evil overlord is like a great like king who rules an empire. This is just like
he's
local.
He's got to be high level.
Gotcha, yeah, exactly. Gotcha. That's my definition of an evil overlord. Okay, that's fair. That's where we get the overlord part.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I'm totally okay with people last stand against a big enemy. That's cool. No, I'm totally okay with that trope, and I can understand why people would like it. I mean, we like to see our heroes like defeat something grand in the end. As you said, we want some big finish.
Right.
It's hard, and you don't want a small finish for a movie, especially if you've been building it up this whole time. And I totally get that. Mm. And so if that's what you're building towards, no. I mean, it's one that people love, obviously, and I love it too. I'm not going to, I love Luke, taking down the Death Star with like everyone else. That's not...
Here's the main reasons. The only way it works, you have to care about both the characters involved and the goal to defeat the main battle. If the main battle doesn't connect with you in any way, shape, or form,
and
you're not connected with the character, like you haven't gone through the whole journey with the characters, you have to go with the journey with the characters and realize how important it is. Those stakes have to be as important to the audience as they are to the characters. Mm-hmm. If they aren't, then it's not worth having, right?
I absolutely agree. And I'm with you. And in fact, that actually connects with what I'm going to list as the next one. I'm going to skip one here and we'll come back to it. A nobody turning into a badass through hard work, grit, and determination.
Right.
Is the next thing that people love on the list.
Yeah, there's a catch with that, though, because that ties in with why the heroic last stand gets on my nerves a lot.
Oh, okay.
Because a lot of stories will have the hero win just because, like, they're the hero.
Yeah.
Right.
And I hate that. The best example of a movie that does that I hate, and it's an example of everything I hate about it, would be the original Karate Kid.
Okay.
Where, like, he's facing the blonde, muscular Ken doll from Cobra Kai, and this is the kid that's picked on in a while, and Daniel-san does his, like, just goofy little stance, and he wins, and yay, and you're like, okay, so let me get this straight. The dumbass whiny kid, who's been doing martial arts for about 2 months, is going to get into the ring and kick the ass of the guy who's been doing martial arts his whole life, lives for nothing but doing martial arts, is inured to pain, doesn't care about the suffering of others at all, is willing to murder Daniel-san. Let's face it, he tried at the beginning.
Yep.
Are you telling me the crane doesn't work? Is that what you're trying to tell me right now? Because I'm getting really upset.
there's worse than that. Because to paint this picture, the guy that's like twice his size, the guy that there is no way on earth that Daniel-san has a chance against. And Daniel-san gets into the ring, and not only does he beat the guy, he cheats. Because they tell you right in the beginning, the ref, no headshots. And Daniel-san takes it and still wins.
I know.
Daniel-san should have been dead.
You're right.
he wins by cheating, and we let it fly because he's the cute, plucky, young, blah, 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 piss off.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that.
No. Everyone does, but he's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why I hate that, because you spend like a whole story explaining why the hero is getting their ass handed to him, and then just because it's the big fight, all of a sudden they just win. I hate. Now, that's not necessarily a problem inherent to the trope, but it shows that idea of people abusing it, because it's just a given. You can do Daniel-san. You can do this guy who has no chance. He has no right to be there, and he cheats. And we let it all slide just because we are so expectant of him winning.
Yep. Well, because he has to win for the audience to feel happy. Sorry, Jack. Mm-hmm. Go.
I was just going to say, this is one of the things that's slightly off, but I remember when you were talking about The Overlord, which I really love the episode, but you were talking about why can't you have more of the episodic single battles kind of thing. I never understood watching a lot of the Japanese, because I think a lot of these inherently came from the Japanese, where you have, like, you know, the overlord kind of character, and they would only send, like, one villain to go after him. Like, why not take the entire season worth of villains? You know, like, they're mini-bosses. Have all 30 of them hit them at once. You'd wipe them out. But no, we'll try this one. Well, that didn't work. We'll try this one. Well, that didn't work. Back to trying for it. Why not 215? It never made any sense to me for that.
Well, there is... So, if I can speak, there is something that's supposed to be going on there. And this is something that they're really bad at. And the Japanese are really bad at. There's an idea there that they've lost, and I don't know where they lost it, at what point. I'm not even sure where they ever had it, but I know it's supposed to be there. The idea is that this overlord is controlling a frickin' empire, okay? His minions are supposed to be out there doing different things in different places. Now, sometimes they actually do mention this, but a lot of times they don't, because it's such a trope they forget to. The idea that, no, just like a real business person running an empire, they often have multiple vice presidents covering different divisions and doing different things. And what's happening is as that, you know, as the VP of, crushing magical girls gets, fails, the VP of conquering school kids gets upgraded into the new VP of bashing magical girls and gets sent after the magical girls to get the legendary moonstone that will rule all reality or something. So
that would make more sense for sure. Yeah.
And that's kind of what they sometimes will mention that. because I've seen shows where they, I'm trying to remember the names, but I've seen shows where they literally say, oh, you're back from the nether regions. And it's like, yes, I have heard that Ugamugian has failed in his quest. And then the evil overlord says, yes, Ugamugian has failed in his quest. Methos, will you now take on the quest to defeat the magical girl? And Methos will say, right. Of course, my lord, I can do much better than Ugamugian. And right. Ugamugian will skulk off to, and then later try to stab Methos in the back or something like that. And that's how it always goes. And they get it from samurai drama. Samurai drama used to do this too. Because
it makes sense.
So that's the idea. But again, it's become such a trope that many shows don't even bother. Literally, all the evil overlords, and Sentai does this horribly too. They all the lieutenants just kind of hang around. They're just like lounging, reading, playing video games. And it's like, oh, look, this loser failed. Okay, I guess I'll do it.
Right.
And that happens way too much. And I agree, that is kind of annoying. But you just... Sorry, go on. You can kind of have to accept it sometimes.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, because there was one series that subverted it. I think it was Ariel.
Okay.
Because that was the one where the guy built the giant robot as a memorial to his wife.
Oh, that one, yes. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
And it wasn't entirely serious, but do you remember one of the running things was that the villain who'd been sent by the evil Galactic Empire to take over the Earth, he kept failing and he kept cutting his budget, so he didn't have the monsters to send every week. That's why he was trying to ration out the ones that he did.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah, because they wouldn't give him any funds so he could buy more monsters. He was kind of stuck with what he had.
And again, this goes back to our same argument. Mm-hmm. If you do the work in the plot to mm-hmm. get you to care about what's going on with the characters, to mm-hmm. understand how these things work, it makes all the difference for the finale, right?
It does. So. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does. And then that finale means a lot. And then you're watching them having the heroic last stand. You care about these characters. You want to see them succeed. You don't want them to die and that's or fail, whatever. And that's the best story. And that's what people love.
For sure.
Just having a generic heroic last stand where a bunch of nobodies like fight a last stand, the audience doesn't care.
Yeah, like, absolutely not.
Unless they're invested. Absolutely.
For sure. They have to be, for sure, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
What's the next one on your list?
Okay, well, just one last thought. The nobody turning into a badass through hard work and grit and determination, I think is kind of a bit of a universal story. I mean, it is one that that people have always loved and always will because it inspires us all. And that's kind of the point.
Do you think it's like done a lot, though, through Asian stories, specifically Japanese?
Oh, hell yes.
It's really come to the fore recently because of game culture, right? Gaming. The idea of, you know, starting at level one and moving your way up and stuff like that. Light novels and the whole bit.
Yep, so. Light novels, web novels, they all use this. They're all based on... now, mind you, they're almost all targeted towards a youth audience. Youth, mm-hmm. especially, love reading this. Because you got to remember, what we're actually doing is we're trying to gain, or at least our brains are trying to gain life knowledge, right? They're trying to learn about how the world works. And this is why the brains of young people, naturally, when they see a story about someone working hard and succeeding in life, their brain naturally pays attention to it. They like that kind of thing because it's like, oh, okay, this is how it's done. This is how that character does it. I can do that too. They don't realize, no, it only works in a fantasy world, which is totally stacked in your favor. But okay, sure, you know, whatever. but that's the majority of stuff, I would argue most stuff, and not just the Japanese, I would bet most non-romance young adult novels are basically that too. Like, I would argue the majority of them probably, and they always have been, to be blunt. I mean, the whole idea of the Bildungs Roman, which I'm mispronouncing, I'm sure, the romantic youth fantasy where youth starts out at the bottom and works his way to the top, the Horatio Alger stories from years ago, which nobody except English teachers remember, but was actually a guy who literally built a huge career on writing these kinds of stories. And even Dickens wrote some of these, right?
Well, even if you think about the stories of Horatio Hornblower, another Horatio,
yep.
that's what's happening with him. He's starting off at the bottom and working his way up to the top.
Oh, and they're great stories. I love Hornblower stories. But anyway, but so yeah, that kind of thing, it's always been there. And it's just, I think it's kind of almost hardwired into us. But we can talk more about that later. Anyway,
cool.
So the next one on the list is the one I skipped was the wise old mentor figure who's also a badass and can kick ass with the best of them. Now, what's interesting about this one is, notice that it's not just the mentor is there, but they also participate, right? They're not just a passive mentor who gives advice. They're also, you know, they are a former badass, and they can still do the badassery when needed.
Right. Like, yeah, like the prisoner from my favorite, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Of course, yes.
He's awesome in it. And what's his name? Who plays in the movie, the 95 movie or the 93 movie. He's just fantastic.
I haven't seen that one.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm surprised you haven't seen it.
Well, because I love the book, and I've always been afraid to actually watch the movies because I just can't imagine the movies doing justice to the book. Really,
it's just so well done. You should absolutely
I'll check out that version. Okay,
I'll tell you who's in it, and it might help. Well, you know who's really interesting? Who's in it? Who plays his son that he doesn't realize it's his son?
Right.
It's a 2002 version, right?
Oh, 2002.
It's the guy who plays Superman now. Oh, as okay. as a young teen, and you're like, I can't believe it. It's him.
It's young Henry Cavill.
It's young Henry Cavill. That's right.
Oh, okay.
So Jim Caviezel, I forget his name.
Oh, yeah,
plays
him.
Edmund Dantes.
Okay.
And Guy Pearce plays Fernand Montego.
Yeah.
And Richard Harris plays the guy who's the prisoner.
Oh, what's his name? He's the priest, right?
Yes, the priest.
Abbe Ferreira. That's him. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. And Mercedes Iguana, she's a wonderful Dagmara. Anyway, and James Frayne plays Villefort, which is a really great casting throughout the whole thing. And Luis Guzman plays Jacopa, which is really a great comedic character. And I can't remember, it's been so long since I've read the book. Can't even remember if he's in that book, but he's a great comedian.
I don't think he is,
character.
But yeah.
So there you go.
But okay, I'll check that version out.
2002 for sure.
Okay, sounds good.
I think it's honestly, and I really would like your thought, it's honestly one of those, if you're going to teach action, it's one of the movies that you should use to teach it. Because it is so well scripted. The script is just brilliant in putting together romance, action, and revenge. So.
Oh, nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts about the wise old mentor figure, Don?
Yeah, I think the idea of the mentor kicking all the ass is important because in most of our stories, kicking somebody's ass is how you win.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not capable of winning, because in a weird way, I think it ties back to the last one, because we've mentioned it before that I think it's kind of a North American thing. We don't always like our heroes to succeed by hard work. Mm-hmm. I think just as often we have heroes that they're just awesome, or there's something inherent to them that makes them awesome.
Right. Okay. Yep. I think that's you know, it's interesting. That's not on this list, but I would argue that's something that everyone wants that, to be blunt. At least every North American wants that. The idea that you can be born awesome and you can win. You know what the movie that bugs me the most about that, ironically enough, is The Lion King. I just saw the stage production of it recently, and it reminded me, and stage production is amazing. It's gorgeous. It's fantastic. It deserves all the hype. No question. But, oh my God, does that story still suck? I really don't like the story of The Lion King, because basically what happens is, to spoil a little bit, but most people have seen it, 20 plus year old spoilers, folks, sorry. The young prince's uncle kills the young prince's father, convinces the prince that he's kind of responsible, so he pisses off, okay?
Oh, you mean Hamlet.
Yeah, well, sort of. And this is where I'd argue. Many people say Hamlet, but that's not exactly what... But no, Hamlet is actually good. This is the difference between Hamlet and The Lion King.
Yes, of course.
In The Lion King, so he goes off and he parties and everything like that. And then, meanwhile, his uncle basically kind of ruins the family fortunes. And so, eventually... the female lead shows up, convinces the prince to come back again, which is not in Hamlet, but there we go. And he comes back and he just wins, and then he's automatically a hero, and that's it. That's the end of the story. Literally, that's the end of the story. Because he's like, oh well, I'm not sure I should go back. Well, you totally should. Well, okay, I guess I can go back. And so he goes back, and because he's young and powerful, and Scar, his uncle, is kind of weak. Ta-da, and he just wins. He's meant
to be the king, yes.
Yeah, and he's also meant to be the king. He just wins. Right. Scar's not even his match.
No.
Like, it's not even like, I mean, there's kind of a pseudo fight between, like, the alliance who now ally against him and Scar and his army of hyenas and such, but not really. And it really still comes down to Simba just walks over, or Kimber, whatever his name is, just walks over and just smacks Scar, and Scar's like, oh, I give up. And then the hyenas eat Scar and it's over. And everything's just wonderful and wonderful again because, our young, like, loser prince basically just bothered to come home and do something that was, like, very simple. And so he just wins and, yay, everything's great, peace is restored. It's like, no, what makes you think this loser is a good king? Like, really?
Well, he did listen to his father's message that he was the king, so therefore...
Yes, he did. He did listen to his father saying, you know, Simba, you are the rightful heir. You should go back and, you know, avenge me. And it's like, okay. And so, I mean, it's one of those stories that the one reason Lion King, this is my theory, is actually popular in both the stage play and the original version is it's got great songs, it's got great visuals, it's well animated. It's literally one of the best examples you can find of style over substance. It has just barely enough substance to hold itself together as a story. Just barely, like the very, like the most, like thinnest you can get away with and still call it a story. And yet, the songs are so good and the characters are so well animated, it's so lively and everything that people just love it anyway. And
didn't you love the Simpsons take where they have, you know, in the clouds?
Yep, that's what I was referring to. Yeah. Listen,
this is CNN.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah.
Yep. But that to me is an example of that where the hero comes back. Yeah, the hero just wins because they're the hero, which is what Don's talking about, which isn't on this list. But the truth is, it's the favorite thing that everyone loves.
Right.
Because it's the old idea of your letter from Hogwarts is just waiting around, is just coming to you. It just hasn't gotten to you yet. It's the whole thing of no, you'll win. It's just a case of you just have to wait a little bit longer.
Yes.
That we sell every generation on.
Well, yeah, because the Lion King, I think, works just because it's such a given that Simba's going to be the hero and be the king. Like, they don't even hide it. He's being groomed from that beginning. But you're absolutely right that he really doesn't deserve any of that victory. Mm-hmm. But just like Daniel-san, and this is why I say it's a trope more than a convention, because it is such a feature of that story that we don't even question it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Yeah, it is. It's just such a trope at this point that we just go with it. We know the audiences love it, and it just works. And it comes back to, that idea that the hero is always right, even though they're not. Like, they always have to be right because they're the audience surrogate. And if the hero is wrong, then the audience is wrong. And that can't happen. So therefore, the hero has to be right.
For sure.
Always. Never always. All right, let's go on to the next one, which is a little bit of a deviation from most of this list, which is it's a bit odd, but it's on the list. Lovecraftian ancient cosmic horror gods.
Right.
But, okay, all right, I guess this is where the edgy guys crept in, because the rest of this story is pretty much, the rest of this list, folks, is heroic fantasy, like, to a hilt, okay? Literally. And then right smack in the middle here is Lovecraftian ancient horror gods, which has nothing to do with heroic fantasy.
No, it does. It's one that, it ties in with something that comes up a little later on this list.
Oh, okay.
Because what ended up happening, and this goes with the idea of how a trope and a convention, how they can develop and transform from one to the other. Because we've mentioned it, if you're doing like Western fantasy, you're either doing Tolkien or you're doing Conan.
Right.
And Conan had a lot of this because Robert E. Howard was friends with H.P. Lovecraft. And there was a group of these authors that wrote like weird fiction, it was called back in the day, that would swap ideas. So what we know is like the Cthulhu mythos that Lovecraft created, probably about 2/3 of it, Lovecraft didn't create. That was other people doing that shtick, and they trade stuff off. So when you read like the old Conan stories, especially the Robert E. Howard ones, there's all these references to Cthulian things. And Howard himself added things to the Cthulhu mythos.
Right.
And that's, I think, one of the reasons why this is a specific derivation of one that, the one about ancient civilizations. That because one of our templates for heroic fantasy, that being the Conan stories,
right,
so heavily made use of it, it's just a given at this point. That's why it's a trope, because we just accept that the dark, inscrutable alien gods are out there in any fantasy setting where people actually sweat.
Okay.
And I think if I recently bought a book from Chapters, which is a big thick tome called Dark Fantasy, only to discover that what they actually do mean is horror fantasy kind of stuff. So that's what they did say. They preferred, many of those writers at the time preferred the word dark fantasy as opposed to horror about their writing. So I think in a very loose way, it does fit with fantasy for that reason. So,
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. And cause Don mentioned it. Another thing on the list is ancient civilization, ancient ruins and tech that plays a part in the story. And I think that that's, I would say, is another, again, it is a trope, a standard trope, that the idea that there was always some ancient civilization in this setting before that fell or collapsed or whatever, maybe because of the ancient Lovecraftian horror gods or whatever. And as Don said, that there's that darkness that's always lurking in the back somewhere and will eventually rear up in some way and usually ends up being summoned up by the bad guys or occasionally the good guys by accident at some point. And that it adds a little bit of an edge to the story. And even in the ones where the heroes don't sweat, I would say you still tend to have that element of dark magic or something lurking there in the background.
Yeah, I think that what happens in the other kind of the non-Conan, because Conan fantasy is where people sweat and then they glisten all muscular and stuff. If you're doing Tolkien fantasy where nobody ever like sweats or farts, the ancient civilization was always a pinnacle. It represents antiquity and the value of history in that. And it was in ancient times when the elven elders had built their great empire, but then it was greed that brought it down. Whereas the Conan ones, because they borrowed from Lovecraft, the ancient world in Conan was like ruled by serpent people. And these like formless blob monsters and stuff. And it was horrifying. And because fantasy wants to evoke this idea of prehistory, of the past, of a weird kind of almost timelessness, that any fantasy setting is a world that's, it's not like ours. They don't have their fancy internets or things like that. You always have, again, history ends where the story starts and stretches way, way back. And depending on which version you have, you're either going to do the ancient gods of horror or the great elven civilization.
Right. Or both sometimes. Sometimes they both existed on different continents on the same planet.
Right.
That's true.
Yes. And they were at war with each other, of course.
Well, yeah.
And that's how it always goes. That's true. That's very true. Okay, so ancient civilization, ancient ruins, and tech play part of the story. Let's move on. So let's go on to another class.
Was Mew at the same time as Atlantis? I always wanted to know.
I don't know.
Were they competing for best?
This is where things get a little tricky, because remember that what our idea of Atlantis is very likely where the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, where a comet hit the Earth about 12,800 years ago and melted a whole bunch of glaciers very quickly and caused flooding all over the place. Didn't flood the whole world or anything like that, but caused the sea levels to rise very suddenly. Right. And wiped out a good chunk of the human race, because most people lived next to the ocean. And I suspect that both Mu and Atlantis are both based on that great flood. And also, that's why every culture in the world has a great flood myth.
Right.
Is because it really did happen, but it didn't really flood the world. And also, we lost most of the civilizations that were around at that point, because they didn't have writings. We don't know exactly. But anyway, whatever. So my point again is this: I don't know when they were supposed to have happened according to the writings, but that's probably where the idea comes from.
Right.
Here's... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Oh, I was going to say that I think what happened, because Atlantis was made up.
Mm-hmm.
Like it appears first in the Timaeus by Plato, and it's a story that's told to this like ancient philosopher guy from the Greeks when he went to Egypt, and the Egyptians said, "Oh, you Greeks don't know nothing because you have no history, and ours goes back a bajillion years. And what you don't realize is your Athenians are actually the ones that kicked Atlantis's ass and freed this part of the world." And it was a story. I think Lemuria and Mu comes later, because I think in like the late 1800s, when people were looking at this idea of Atlantis and they were trying to combine up all these different Pacific civilizations, I think that's where Mu came from. It was a theory that was devised to explain all of these different little sniglets of civilization that existed in that area.
Right.
That's cool. Possible. And of course, they were actually wrong. We've actually, thanks to genetic testing, we actually know where they all came from. And the answer, believe it or not, is Taiwan. Well, sort of. What basically happened is that they've done genetic testing, and they discovered that it looks like at some point people immigrated from China and Asia. They went to Taiwan. This is like thousands of years ago or longer. And then those people began working, those ancient Taiwanese Aboriginal people. They'd be called the Aboriginal Taiwanese now. They're not the Taiwanese people who live there right now. These are the Aboriginals, mm-hmm. they call them. They began working their way down through the Philippines, through Indonesia. They discovered, for example, that the Taiwanese Aboriginal people are basically the Maori people from New Zealand. And they're the people who live on like Easter Island. They're all genetically connected to each other.
And did you listen to the Mysterious Universe where there's somebody who's making the arguments that we didn't come out of Africa, we came out of Australia?
I have heard that one. Yeah.
I would like to see the actual papers that are coming out of that, because apparently those are hitting the presses as we speak. It'd be very interesting to see what they come up with. So,
I don't know about that, because again, we do know that there have been a couple cataclysms where the human race has nearly been wiped out. It's really hard to say, because what may have happened is we could have still come from, let's say we came from Africa, but then the human race, that part of the human race got wiped out, and the survivors just happened to be in Australia, and then they spread back over the world again from Australia. And so we came from Australia, but no, we actually did still come from Africa, or maybe it's the reverse.
Yes.
I mean, so it's really hard for us to judge some of these things, right? Because we don't have the...
Yeah.
The best we could do is hope for is we have the DNA of some like ancient bones or something like that.
Well,
that we
this can is what he's to. Coming up with, right? This is, okay. I don't know if you've, he's they're talking about actual DNA evidence to suggest that the variety and dynamic elements of the DNA actually come from Australia, not from, because that's what we were using as sort of like a DNA reverse bomb, right? To figure out where genetics has been moved out, and they were saying that the evidence seems to show that it's far more diverse and. In Australia than it is even in Africa, kind of thing. And you can you can look genetically backwards and find like early Australian stuff in the DNA. I'm agnostic to it because I want to see the evidence, but it's interesting theory, right?
It is. I don't know. I mean, actually, I've heard another version of the theory where basically that it's actually Asia, China in that area that where we started out. Sure. Although I think that's closer to we restarted there after an apocalypse rather than we actually started there properly. But that's because there are no primates really. Well, I mean, no, that's not true. They do have monkeys. They do have monkeys in Asia. But I think part of our theory comes from the fact that the closest primates to us, the chimps and the apes, though, are in Africa. They're not in China. They're not in that area. I don't know. Anyway, but here we definitely have ancient civilizations in our past that play a part in the story of humanity. There's no question on that, and it is kind of cool to bring that stuff up sometimes. All right. So next on the list is, and this is what this is the original. I'm not saying this myself. Okay. Motherfucking dragons. That's actually what it says here. I'm not and for better or for worse, everyone loves dragons.
Is that the case? Though, how many different dragon things do we really have, though? Like, comparatively, like, I would argue we get far more zombie movies than we get dragon movies.
Well, that's true, but we are talking about in fantasy tropes that people love, like, right. dragons in their fantasy. This is different than modern
this
stuff.
This is strictly in fantasy.
This is strictly in fantasy, yes.
Gotcha.
Okay. And in that case, there are dragons in almost everything.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because you need something to put in your dungeons.
You do. You need something to guard your dungeons. You need something to get to for this that lets the heroes fly. Because remember, dragons often take the place of jet fighters in a lot of places.
That's true.
Or tanks. That's right. Very often jet fighters, especially since Reign of Fire. And yeah, I mean, so I can understand. And of course, we love
Dinotopia.
Yep. We love our big lizards. We really do.
That's right.
And you know, the symbol of power. The only thing that bugged me about dragons, let's go into this, is the fact that, properly speaking, humans are far more effective in fantasy against dragons than they should be in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It shouldn't even be a contest. Like, no. Like, they should, unless we're dealing with like a really weak dragon or a baby dragon or something, they should just go through us like a hot knife through butter. It's not really, like, the hero with the sword and the shield who runs up to face the dragon. No, that's not going to work, dude. That just won't work.
No, yeah.
I mean, I'll give Game of Thrones this, that when they finally had to deal with dragons, at least the bad guys decide, you know, giant motherfucking crossbows. That's the way you deal with dragons.
That's right. Yeah.
And
before they even get here, it ultimately failed. Yeah, before they even get here, hit them with a crossbow 2 miles away, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it still failed for that
And it
reason.
Still ultimately fails because once the dragons know you're coming, they can just dodge the bullets. Although that quickly gets into, look, there's 100 shots coming at her and she just dodges around them like a Japanese, like, jet fighter, anime jet fighter thing. It's like, whoa, look at her go. But whatever. Anyway, the point is that, yeah, dragons, they're awesome, but they're seriously, I would argue, underpowered in fantasy, not overpowered.
Well, even in Dungeons and Dragons, the game, there was a considered effort to like to power them up, because they were one of the things that people was like, yeah, I'm gonna kill myself a red dragon, a white dragon, blue dragon, so I can get treasures MZ4, you know, all those different letter treasures you had in Dungeons and Dragons.
That's true.
And then they thought, no, the idea that dragons attack 3 times per round. Let's make that 16, because there's like all these different things that they can do at the same time. So, yeah,
exactly. And
that. Oh no, go ahead.
No. I was gonna say just the size. I mean, I always thought about this. Okay, so you run up at a dragon, you hit it with a caveat at it with a sword. It's not gonna hurt it. Like, what are you doing? Like, the scale on the dragon, you're just not gonna hurt it. Like, I mean, you would literally have to find the joints and everything to like kind of stick your sword into and. That's not going to work very well either, because it's going to get you before you get there, unless you get really lucky. Like, I can
see... To be fair, Disney's Dragon Slayer did a really good job of showing how hopeless
that's
that
true.
Is.
Oh, yeah, good point. Good point, yep.
Yeah. I notice everybody hated that movie.
Yep.
So. Yeah.
Because
it kills the fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you guys are both kind of bumping up into one of the problems that a lot of stories have is... A lot of people don't understand how injury works. And there's a lot of like injury related things that they become tropes because you see it so often that people don't know. Because the biggest problem with, say, fighting a dragon with a sword isn't necessarily it. Part of it is going to be getting through the scales. But even if you do, it's hitting something important enough to do it any real damage. Like, are you going to have the weight and the mass to put that sword through the dragon's skull? Probably not. Like, are you going to hit a major organ? Well, realistically, the way like your typical Western dragon is portrayed, not only are they going to have a thick hide, but they're going to have a lot of like, it looks like they carry on like a lot of fatty tissue in that. And that's going to just absorb the blade. That's why the giant crossbow works, because if I can put enough of it into the dragon, I can maybe hit deep enough to hit a major organ.
Yep, exactly.
But people don't know that. They think that because again, I think the gamerisms that have crept into stories, if I just whack you enough times with my sword, I'll eventually do enough to overcome your hit points and I win.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's exactly it. This is where we get into the gamerism of, yeah, hit points, where it doesn't work in some of these situations. It's not like the dragon is a block of cheese that you're just whittling away the hit points.
Unless it's a cheese dragon.
God knows there probably is one in second edition.
Cheese dragons.
Lord knows there probably favorite. Is one somewhere, yeah.
Well, the big thing I think they did in Dragon Slayer and a couple of others was you have to get between the scales, which is so difficult to find that kind of spot, right?
Because
there's usually a very small spot that you say, the idea that, yeah, you can't get through their armor. They're just too tough.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're also attacking you at the same time with something that can kill you in one hit.
Yes.
This thing, dragons, should be terrifying, but D&D actually, if anything, made them kind of wimpy. And that's why, like, just like, oh, they're just the thing you kill at the end of the dungeon. They're the level boss. It's like, no.
Right. No.
Well, not for a decent dragon.
Kind of, because there's a certain kind of thing, and this goes with, again, with gaming tropes working their way into other entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
The very, very original D&D, dragons were supposed to be scary, and stat-wise they were scary. But what people don't realize is when the game was written, when Gygax put it all together, he didn't think that people were going to have like high-level characters, that being anything over level 8.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in the very original, like, deities and demigods for, like, the white box one, that the reason they put things like Zeus in and gave him stats is because Zeus is supposed to come in and just kick the ass of the party. Like, the idea of a group tough enough to beat, like, the ruler of the gods is ridiculous. And dragons were another thing. It was almost supposed to be crazy that, like, an ancient one, your group could actually beat them.
Mm-hmm.
But he never anticipated the idea that people would just play and play and play and play and stockpile magic weapons and equipment and have, like, a 40th level character. Like, that was considered absolutely ridiculous. But it worked the other way around, because for the participants, and again, it's a gaming trope that any game is just a target-rich environment, that they would see the mighty dragon as what we build up to so we can kill it and take its treasure. And and that's, I think, you're right that they get underpowered because of that, because if you look at dragons in stories prior, it's really only the hero that kills them, and it's only because God and or an ancient, like, you know, powerful wizard or demon or whatever gives them the special ability or magic sword or special, like, poison thing, or if you swing Medusa's head in front of it. Like, it's a godlike task, but, you know, when my 1d8 sword can eventually gnaw my way through, provided I got enough hit points to survive his 3 gas attacks, like... it goes that other way, that now they're just another encounter.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly what happened on.
Cool.
Okay. So there's dragons. All right, let's move on to the next one. A prophecy that turns out to mean something different than what people had originally thought.
I think I've only ever seen that happen once.
No, that happens. It happens from time to time. This is fantasy tropes from books primarily.
Right.
And in novels that happens quite a bit because
really,
yeah, it does actually. Most of the books that Brandon Sanderson writes, for example, that usually happens. If there's a prophecy, yeah, it'll usually be something that's messed up. Usually there's one in Game of Thrones has some prophecies kicking around, and they end up meaning different things than what people thought. No, it's pretty standard. You could even argue Star Wars does. Because, of course, you know, he's there to bring balance to the Force. Well, yes, he does, by killing all the Jedi, because it was out of balance. Everyone thought he was going to be the Chosen One. They literally say that. You're the Chosen
One. You were supposed to be the Chosen One. Yes.
There we go. But the problem is that, yeah, he was the Chosen One. It was totally out of balance. There were, like, 2 Sith, and there were, like, 5,000 Jedi. Well, got to balance that out.
Huh.
He brought balance to the Force. Why? What one were you thinking of, Don?
The only, like, for movies, that the only example I could really think of was the first Lego movie.
Oh yeah, yep. That they did a good job with that one. Yep.
They did the best because to spoil it for anyone listening, the whole premise was that they were waiting for the special because this wizard guy, when he was killed off by the main villain, his last words were that the special would come around and would defeat the evil like overlord and blah blah blah. And they find this guy that they think is the hero, but he's a schmo. And at the end, the ghost of the wizard says, "No, I just made that up because I figured if people had a goal, eventually somebody would come around who could beat this guy." And I'm like, "Oh my God, that's brilliant."
It is. Exactly. No, that makes total sense. Yeah, I agree. That's a good example of subverting the whole prophecy thing. But I would say it's pretty standard to have prophecies. And again, they pretty much never quite mean what people think they mean because they're usually vaguely worded, right?
Right.
And that's part of the big twist at the end, usually, that comes around. It's like, oh, so actually the prophecy that said you could only be killed by someone, not born of women, going back to Shakespeare's time.
Famous Macbeth, I was going to mention, yeah.
Yeah. I was born by cesarean section, motherfucker. Donk.
Yeah.
And, that technically counts. I mean, yeah. I mean, so we've been doing the whole prophecy that doesn't quite turn out to what people think it means for a long time. Literally hundreds of years.
For sure.
Yep. All right. I'm sure he probably ripped that off from some ancient Greek plays that I'm not aware of too.
Absolutely.
They love their prophecy, so he must have. I'm going to bet they probably had that back in those days too.
Oh, big time, yeah.
All
Well,
right.
think about the Sphinx.
Oh, that's true.
You know, very famous, but anyway.
Yep. All right. So let's move on then, because we're almost done the list. So, former villain gets redeemed and teams up with the main character. The Japanese love this one. They love this one more than anything else on this list, practically.
Yeah. I was going to say, you've just described Naruto.
I've just described pretty much every Japanese action story ever. Even sports,
Yeah.
here, it doesn't matter. I've even seen shoujo girls comic dramas that actually do this trope. Eventually, one of the main bad guys, if not the main lieutenant usually, will end up working with the main character at some point. Now they might not always completely go over to the main character's side. They might actually be that they might actually be fighting a third party or something like that. But yeah, I've seen so many variations of this. I've even seen one where his own organization teamed on the evil overlord when they found out he was like planning to destroy the whole world. They're basically like, no. And so everyone, good guys and bad guys, all teamed up against him. I've even
Right.
seen that version done. But yeah, the Japanese always, there's going to be some villain that's going to team up with the hero at some point. He might not completely go good,
Yeah.
but he'll team up at some point.
You often get that in comic books too. Like you have like a familiar villain that people love,
Yeah.
and he ends up, having the wrong liaison with somebody, and then ends up, joining the team. Well, heck, just back to the evil overlord thing we were talking about before. That happens in the Avengers trilogy, right? Loki
Yep,
ends up being an ally to try to stop Thanos for that
in the
reason
end,
too.
yep, you're right. Yeah, Loki actually goes through his whole little character arc journey and like Thor, and eventually ends up working with the good guys and that. So yeah, you do get that kind of thing happening, even in American stuff. Not as commonly though. I mean, not
No.
as in not at least in superhero comics. Because
Yeah.
remember, we still have that idea that good is good and bad is bad, and never shall the twain meet.
Yeah.
You've seen it more pop up in the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years since the Japanese stuff has had an influence, and we've gotten a lot more anti-heroes, especially since the 90s. So there's a lot of characters like the Punisher is a good example. When the Punisher first appeared, he was a villain. And then I know he's from the 80s, but whatever. And then eventually but he was so cool and everyone loved him, they decided, well, we'll make him an anti-hero, and he's gonna be teaming up with the heroes he was fighting before, and eventually, that so that kind of went that well that became cool, I guess. But people love when the villain gets redeemed in some way and teams up with the main character.
Well,
Bringing
go
that
down.
back, I wanted your thought as to why Wizard of Earthsea never really caught on in Western culture.
I would be the wrong person to ask because I never read it.
Because it was considered to be like the big thing. Are you
I
not
do
an Ursula
remember
K. Le Guin fan? Have you ever read her stuff?
It was super pop. I actually haven't. It was super popular when I was in high school, probably the same time you were. I remember it being super popular, but I wasn't really into. I was kind of going through a phase where I wasn't reading books at that point. I had a in the high school, I had a non-book read, and so I'm just like I was aware of it, but I wasn't even interested enough to know what it was about. It's just like, oh, it's something about a wizard and stuff, and that was kind of that. I didn't really care that much. But I know this kind of, I do know enough to, about it to know this kind of ties in. I really should still read it. Actually, I really should read that at some point.
It is a classic you should read. It's kind of like, if you miss out on Lord Fowl's Bane and stuff like that, you're missing out on like the second wave reaction to Lord of the Rings, right?
Right.
Because these came out around 70s. These are reaction against Lord of the Rings style stuff.
Right.
As opposed to before it, right? In that reason, so.
Don, have you read Wizard University?
No.
I didn't think so. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's one book that we'll have to table and maybe come back to after we've read it or something like that.
Sure.
Yep, yep. And I'll make a point of reading it at some point. Anyway, okay, was there a way you wanted to go with that without talking about Wizard University specifically, or do you just want to move on?
No, I just wanted to move on. That was my
Okay, so
just the thought of that.
So. Just thought of that. I remember it came up in our earlier conversation. You mentioned how it ends anyway. All right, so let's see. Okay, we're almost done. Magic swords with cool powers. Well, everyone loves their magic swords.
Now, is it always magic swords or is it just magical weapons?
I would argue magic weapons, but you know, swords just kind of have that mystique. Like,
they do.
Nobody, you know, talks about the great hero with their mace. I mean, maybe occasionally if it's a dwarven fighter or something, but that's always the hero's buddy, right? That's not the actual hero themselves. In our culture, the hero, because they're, remember, the sword is the weapon of nobility. So a hero is someone who wields a sword.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that comes from, like, Excalibur?
Yeah.
Because I know if you go back to Greek myths, there's the sword of the stone that's pulled by Theseus. They never mention the sword again. It's just a gimmick for him to go see his father, right?
Right, yeah.
So it's not the same. I think Excalibur is the first one that I know of that's like, and Caliburn, if you go read it, the originals, it's the original sort of magical sword which does all the cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. No. I think that's Excalibur is a big part of it. The Legend of Arthur. I mean, let's just face it, the swords were standard weapons again of nobility, and that's what I want to emphasize. Because I think that common people use spears, and as they did in the new medieval ages, but real men use swords. And it goes so if you are the once and future king, you're going to be using a sword. That's just kind of given.
Well, he had a spear too. He had a magical spear called Ron, of all things.
King Arthur did?
King Arthur did. Yeah, I'm a big King Arthur nerd. So, yeah, he had a magical spear called Ron. But think about the Spear of Destiny, too. That says something. If the spear is more of a commoner's kind of thing, then anyone can hold the Spear of Destiny, which is kind of fascinating.
I think that's part of it. Actually, well, I'll tell you something that's interesting is that there are other cultures that have different takes on that. In Japan, it's the sword. I mean, the samurai swords and everything, right? Mm-hmm. But if you go to China, it's the halberd.
Oh, interesting.
They actually, to them, that if you look at their traditional, like, the Legend of the Three Kingdoms characters, they're all about the halberd, which is a kind of pole arm. They thought that pole arms were the weapons of, like, the real men, so to speak. So this is why you'll see Chinese heroes will almost always wield pole arms, or sometimes even spears. They do have swords, like they have gen, Chinese swords, but they, for some reason, they tend to prefer pole arms a lot. Like that,
well, pole arms are hard to wield, so I can see why, you know what I mean? Like, they're not just your regular spear. There's a lot of thrusting and also slashing, so they take more skill for that reason.
Well, there's another level with the Chinese stuff, which is they were usually used by mounted warriors, and the pole arm is a mounted warrior's weapon.
For sure.
So there's that too. Plus, you can have some big ass pole arms, and that as you said, they're hard to wield. But boy, do they do damage if they hit. So you'll find that there are other cultures. The Mongolians, for example, it was all about the bow. The bow was the weapon, because remember they were horse archers. A warrior's weapon was the bow, and you'll find that in Mongolian mythology and such. If you go with different cultures, you'll find different weapons. It's not always swords, but swords are a pretty good kind of multi-purpose killing tool.
Right.
They are.
Yeah, because one of the earliest references maybe, because it's a little vague, to a magic weapon. It was a mace.
Oh, okay.
And that was, if you've read The Odyssey, mm-hmm. there's the one guy who has, like, Hercules's maul, mm-hmm. which maul is, it's either like an armored glove or like a club, mm-hmm. depending right. on how you translate it. And it was referenced that this thing is just, like, impossibly huge and powerful. So it might be a magic weapon. It might just be, like, a freakish weapon, but right. that's the earliest reference to something like that I can think of.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cause I do think that, yeah, the sword is like Rob says, if you were like the hoi polloi in medieval Western culture, you carried a sword, and all a lot of the fantasy we're exposed to draws kind of from the Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that might even be when you mention the Spear of Destiny, that comes out of like Christian theology and mythology.
Yep.
And Christianity was always billed as a religion of the masses, that it was this poor carpenter guy that started it and that. Mm-hmm. And that could be one of the reasons why that the spear takes on that particular.
No, that makes absolute perfect sense. It's a commoner's weapon. It's the weapon of the people. So therefore, mm-hmm. the Spear of Destiny. No, that I totally yeah. get that.
And you need some kind of weapon, because even if your religion preaches peace, that's not going to put asses in pews. You need those, like, super awesome... Because there's a sword in the Bible, too, but it only gets referenced once.
Right.
And that was... It was Peter that cuts off the guard's ear.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
With his sword when they come to take Jesus.
Right,
but yeah. for some reason, that blade, Peter's blade, never comes up again, as far as I know, in any kind of story or history or mythology.
It's wow. interesting. Well, that cool. blade wasn't supposed to be magical or special, but the one that poked Jesus was, I guess.
Well, because it's notable, is what it amounts to. And
for sure.
that same mythologizing could easily be applied to, like, Peter's sword.
That's true. Yeah, you could yep. do that to Peter's sword. There you go, fantasy writers. There's a weapon that hasn't been used yet to death. So therefore, go for it.
Sword of Peter.
Sword of Peter. Exactly. All right.
Sounds vaguely pornographic.
It does. That's exactly what I was thinking.
That's the porn parody of the Bible, anyway. That's right.
Here you go.
Oh, I'm sure there are a few.
If they did Flesh Gordon, they have to have done that, too.
So. Oh, I guarantee you they have. All right, and so let's go with the last one on our list, which is a group of dysfunctional characters team up to go on a quest.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They meet at the inn.
Yeah, they meet at the inn. So why do they have to be a group of dysfunctional characters?
Because they have to grow and change and become what they are. If they're already there,
mm-hmm.
then there's nothing for them to learn. Not even cooperation. Which is right. the number one thing you have to learn as a group, right?
They always
it's all about yep. cooperation, folks. So, mm. yeah.
No. Well, and let's face it, dysfunctional means drama, and it means they're interesting yeah. or entertaining.
Exactly.
And so you need that. And the quest, well, they got to have something to do, right? Something to unite them all, and something mm-hmm. to bring them yeah. together.
There you go. I'm going to call it an audio drama show, a new one called Continuum Force. There you go, J.C. Torre. Latore. Okay. He wrote one, and yeah, well, no, the reason why is that people were complaining, like some people I know was like, these guys are awful. They're terrible at what they do. They're always fighting the whole bit. And then about episode 5, you find out, spoiler alert, that's why they were put together, because they never wanted this force to work in the first place. So right. like the person who put them all together tried to make it fail. It was a great way to be able to come up with that trope or the idea of yep. these people, you know, aren't very good at what they do. And what do? That you do that on purpose, right? So
I'm pretty right. sure I've seen that before.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm pretty sure I've seen that where the heroes are all different because they're supposed to fail. That's kind of the point.
Right, right.
They're supposed to take. I can't remember any specific example, but I know I've seen that before.
Yep.
Was it Stripes? Did Stripes do that? I'm trying to
Not
remember.
Not exactly. Stripes the whole...
Police
the whole
Academy definitely did that.
Yeah. Oh,
Police Academy did. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go.
See, and then you discover that the real treasure was inside you all the time. It was friendship.
Right. Oh, exactly. There we go. So, you know, all of these tropes, almost all of them, actually seem to fit together in some way. And they all seem kind of familiar, Jack. I mean, Do you know some way to like link a lot of these tropes together? I mean, could we put them into some kind of structure or order?
Well, if there was only a journey a hero could go on, then we could put it all together. Wait a minute, the hero's journey. Yes, of course. Yes, it follows the hero's journey. And I know we've had this discussion about the hero's journey. And while my version of the hero's journey, I think, is a little more universal, obviously, I break it down to a lot more simplistic pieces. But it's not certainly it's not all stories. I mean, you can't have those exciting stories about going and learning how to camp, you know?
Hey, laid back camp is awesome. You shut your mouth.
Oh,
I love back camp is okay. That's a real comic, by the way, and TV and anime show, by the way. It's about girls learning to camp, and it is awesome, dude.
It is. Just as awesome as the guy who learns how to become like a manga artist. That's really exciting stuff too.
You haven't read Bakuman yet, have you?
You guys have given it to me, and I read the first episode, and I was like, okay, when are we going to get to the story? Because there's nothing happening.
That is the story. It's about young people trying to become manga artists. That is the story.
But there's no plot.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, there is. Rob just told you.
Yes. No. That's an idea. That's what we call like. Okay, you've got an idea there, but where is the plot?
And the thing is, they go through a series of challenges. No. They follow. Bakuman follows actually a lot of the stuff on this list. Actually, Bakuman isn't a. It actually is a hero's journey. I would argue Bakuman is one. Wouldn't say that it's not, because it follows this. Which of these, Jack, would you say definitely falls under the standard hero's journey stuff? Well, we definitely got the mentor. There's no question on that.
For sure. Wise old mentor, for sure.
Yep.
Grit and determination.
Yep.
We don't have to worry about the Lovecraftian ancient gods. That's just your dragon at the end, right? The main villain, right? A prophecy usually is involved, right? For the same kind of thing. The former villain, not necessarily. That doesn't have to work. Usually some sort of magical, it doesn't have to be a sword, but it has to be some kind of magical thing. It could be an amulet or a ring or something like that. That's a part of it. And again, it doesn't have to be an ancient civilization. Many of those things that they have there are settings.
Yeah, they're setting elements.
Part of the plot.
Yeah,
right?
They're not part of the plot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, for the most part, and even the dysfunctional group of characters, that's basically just a trope. That's not even, or you could even argue convention, depending. I mean, however you want to go. But yeah, a lot of the ones that are the plot elements are mostly just standard hero's journey stuff. Which, surprise, they've been working for hundreds, maybe thousands or tens of thousands of years. So, surprise, they still work.
For sure.
And so that comes into it. So that comes into the idea of, you know, why do they still work? Why does this hero's journey stuff still work even till today? Like, what do humans get from this that actually makes us still find these appealing?
I think it's like music, though. You know what I mean? Like, there are certain notes that just come across as discordant, right?
That's true.
And so unless you do it for a purposeful reason, you have to be a really good musician, you're never going to put these two notes together, right? If you put them together, then you have to be able to move off of them or be able to draw attention in some way from the song so that people will be listening towards. So it takes an expert to be able to get off of that list or get off of that, because people will walk out of a movie going, oh, that movie sucked. Really? Because I really liked all of it. Yeah, but the ending sucked, therefore the movie sucked, right? Mm-hmm. So if you miss certain elements within that hero's journey, miss certain elements within that story, people look for them. And maybe it's just because people like a story that's familiar, or maybe it's they like that they, you know, things feel like they should go a certain way. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, you know, you sit there and you'll say things like, you know, okay, so where did the alien come from?
Right.
The alien wasn't in the movie anywhere through. We're looking at a medieval, this is my Jack Ward's axiom, the Green Lantern axiom. I told you about that before, right?
Yep.
Whereas like the more strange things you add to something, the more dimensional things you add to it, the harder it is to keep people's disbelief in place.
Yeah.
So that's the same kind of thing as like the more you get off of what people expect to see in a story, the harder it is for them to enjoy it. The trick isn't to get off of what the pattern is. It's to hide the pattern so much they don't notice it. That's the real trick, I think, in a good writing.
Right.
Because you go back and you look at it again, and you're like, oh, of course. Like, now, it may sound like a bit of a cliche here, but I went to the movie The Matrix not knowing anything about it, which is great, mm-hmm. right? I was in Halifax, and I was looking to watch a movie, and I was sucked right in, the first one, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Because I was so sucked in, I was ready to believe he was dead at the end. He was shot because they'd given me the rules. I'd followed the rules. I saw the whole thing. I didn't see where they were going, and I was, like, sucked right in. And therefore, I could go back and look at it and go, oh, my God, this movie's been done 1,000 different times in the same way with just using this setting. But they did it such a good job of hiding at the time that I really, really had a good time with it. So,
yeah, okay. Hmm. I can totally see that. And I think that I think you're right. I think there are certain notes that appeal to us. Although I think stories are a little bit different than music in that sense. Like I said, I'm of the, how can I put it? I take the evolutionary psychology view of stories, if this hasn't come up yet, which is that stories serve a purpose. Like we wouldn't, and the elements of stories serve a purpose. Our brains like them for a reason. Now, I think that some of it is a hack, like we're using to create entertaining stories. We're figuring out what people's brains like and what they don't. And so we're playing on those ideas over and over again. That's where conventions come in. But I do think that everything in the stories ultimately did, at least originally, come from a purpose. Like it's there for a reason. And that reason might just be because it plays on certain emotions, for example, that we enjoy feeling that emotion. I mean, there's no question that good stories are about tension and release, right? You build the audience up and you take the tension off, and you build them up and you take the tension off, and you're doing it in such a way that's generating an emotion. It's keeping them interested. It's keeping them focused. And that's awesome. But I still can't help but wonder if even these tropes all do serve a purpose, like that they all actually do are things that, like I mentioned earlier, okay, the young person who becomes, who turns into a badass. Well, that tells us that anyone can do it, right? We all just have to buckle down and do it. It's a pathway to success. Although we completely subvert that by, as we talked about earlier, the Lion King thing, where we basically just make everyone a natural genius who just doesn't have to bother with that badass stuff. We just pay lip service to it. The heroic last stand, I think, comes from the idea of just telling people not to give up. You know, that no matter how overwhelming things go, if you and your buddies and everyone stands together, if we all work together, we can beat anything. I think that comes in.
So you're saying that there's themes that we just love to recreate over and over again.
Exactly, because they appeal to us. Yeah, there's themes and messages that we just create over and over again. And they're messages that we love those messages, either because they reinforce something that we want to believe about ourselves and about the world, or that they are something we aspire to about the world.
I'll bet you that those themes and messages, and Don would probably, I'm speaking for Don already, but Don would probably agree with this too, where there's these themes and messages sort of have cyclical elements too, right? So you see when you're in the middle of the war and people are desperate to get away from that, the themes and messages are more about a frivolous nature, trying to get back to a sort of an easier time, right? And then, you know, you get out of that and there's no work and people are trying to reflect that, and you get the noir aspect, right? So then the themes and messages sort of fit a bit of a cultural aspect. And now, of course, they're also conventionally fitting sort of more motifs. Maybe we took it motifs as well, because that now you're seeing superhero motifs, right? That are fitting, that are more interesting. So people go through various cycles as to what that is.
Right.
I think.
No, I think you're right. And I think these change over time, and they change depending on, we've talked about this in the show many times, about how, you know, the stories reflect society. They reflect the world of the people that are telling these stories and the experiences that they're telling, of the tellers and the audience. And so, of course, the tropes are going to change and the motifs are going to change. But there is some stuff, and I'd say at least some things like the nobody, etc., and the final battle and the mentor and all that stuff. Some of that's just universal, which comes back to, of course, Joseph Campbell's idea of the hero's journey. That some elements are universal for most stories, at least these kinds of stories.
And they're always reflecting either hopes or fears, you know, like they're you know, coming to ideas and themes and motifs and moving away from, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So understanding who we are wanting to be something better kind of thing.
Exactly. So, I would agree with that. Yep. And of course, there's also the always favorite stroking the audience's ego among other body parts. I mean, let's face it, you know, delivering a whole heaping helping of wish fulfillment almost never goes wrong.
Right.
And that's where the magic swords with cool powers comes in. I should have thought of that earlier, because that's mostly about, remember, a magic sword is also an object or whatever, amulet, whatever. You can just give, it's a magic sword because you can give it to anyone and they instantly become a hero.
Right.
Hmm.
Like, so it doesn't matter if you're Billy from down the street or if you're, you know, Susio from the next block over, doesn't matter. I can give that magic sword to either of those kids and congratulations, they just became a hero. And so there's that idea of all the only thing standing between me and being a great hero is I just need that magic item to transform me into something greater.
Right.
Which of course lets you create heroes that are more relatable because they're average people. They've just been transformed by a magic item or whatever. And it also lets you just kind of play on the whole wish fulfillment aspect that, anyone could do this.
Cool.
Right. You don't have to be born on the planet Krypton to be able to do it. Anyone can have a magic sword and suddenly be a winner.
For sure.
Huh.
Cool.
Hmm.
Of course. Now, does all of that mean that the Joseph Campbell's hero's journey is like the ultimate mega trope?
That's a proto argument.
Prototrope.
Yeah.
Well, he wrote it, remember, as an analysis of just like, here's what he found. It wasn't intended to be a writer's manual. That got created by other people later on.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's just like he uncovered some of the elements that put it together and said, this is what people are doing. And then other people said, in typical fashion, other people said, this is what you have to do. Which exactly. is the stupid thing, right? And Joseph Campbell never would have said that either, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. He never would have said that all stories are the hero's journey because they're not. He would have said that, but this is a common, these are common elements that That's appear right. in many stories, many or most stories that he's come up with. It wasn't until Vogler put it into the writer's journey that everyone said, oh my God, this is the right way to do it. Cause he actually told Hollywood, hey, the hero's journey, it's like the perfect thing ever. Even though Lucas had used it like 10 years before and told everyone about it, but whatever. It wasn't until Vogler actually said, hey, this is the perfect blueprint for films. And Hollywood said, ooh. And now I've literally seen like producers and that literally go up to writers and say, hey, you okay? This is the movie I want you to write in. By the way, have you read The Hero's Journey? Here's a link to The Hero's Journey. This is how you write a story.
Right.
I've seen producers do that, the script writers, especially young ones or new ones at that. And because that's like, yeah, here's because they literally, they think of it as the template. That's right, all right, they see right. it as, is a template for writing a story.
Not a good idea.
No, but I mean, it is good to know it, at least to some degree, so you know what the key elements are and you know what you're supposed to subvert. But I still think that it can very easily turn into a straitjacket. And yes, that happens.
You're right with that.
Yeah, sure. and that's my worry about the hero's journey, is that it just becomes a straitjacket for writers that everyone has to follow, which I don't think is correct. I mean, you should be able to play with it. You should be able to structure it the way you want to. There might be certain elements. Sure, because there's certain stuff that works.
That's the benefit of being able to understand the form, because then you know where you can move off of it and where it works and where it doesn't. But you got to understand the form first. It's like martial arts and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. They teach you the basics so you understand how it works, and then they say, okay, now you can play, right?
Yep.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. So on that note, I think we'd better bring this one to a close. So, Don, you've been somewhat quiet for a little bit. Any thoughts?
Well, I was, like I said, I was listening to it. I think even the hero's journey, because you mentioned nobody really cared till Lucas brought it up, and then everybody cared. Even that can be part of this idea that you go from a technique to a convention to a trope and then back to a technique. That it's all cyclical. And I think it's fluid, too, because what we'll consider, say, a genre tends to be a collection of tropes and conventions. And even then, it's fluid. And I think that's why, like I'm always saying, when we have these talks and use these terms, they're academically useful, but it's best not to get wrapped around the axle over it because they change. Even like the best example, what's considered a superhero now – mm-hmm. wasn't 20 or 30 or 40 or 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's true. What they are is changes. There's no question on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so hopefully you, the audience, have been given some food for thought by this. We try not to get too negative about things, although I'm not sure we quite succeeded in that, but whatever. We were kind of all over the place. But as you can tell, this is a subject that we and many other people are very passionate about. And I think the whole idea of tropes has caused a lot of discussion on the internet over the last decade or so. But as Don said, it's not something you should get too wrapped around the axle about. It's just something that yeah, okay, these are stuff people do. Mind you, if you are planning to write in a particular genre, I do think it's important you know what the tropes are or conventions are for that genre, because the audience often does expect it.
For sure.
Okay, yeah. So thank you once again, Jack, for dropping by.
Thanks
and
for having me, guys.
Adding your
Love
voice.
It.
Okay, and thank you, Don, and thank you, listener, for listening. If you've got further thoughts or comments or anything like that, please drop by obeythedna.com and check out the show notes and join the conversation. Until then, next time, stay frosty. Good night.
Tired of these motherfucking dragons in this motherfucking dungeon.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you'd like to hear more or join the conversation, come visit us at obeythedna.com. You can also find us on iTunes or whatever fine podcast site forgot to lock their back door. So until next time, remember that to master the nerdly arts takes time, practice, and enough Coca-Cola to drop a rhino. See ya!